Yeah, the topic I'm going to talk now came a little bit accidentally to me because I was for 9 years a member of an international research school we established between Beijing and Hamburg. And actually two PhD students from the research school are today with us. It's Sebastian Beschke and it's Christina Köhn. After a lengthy discussion, when we established this research school, we came across a topic which unified people from neuroscience, people from psychology, people from computer science in Beijing and in Hamburg under the topic of cross-modal interaction in natural and artificial systems. And so I had the task to find out what I can contribute to this particular topic. And my idea was to stress the cross-modal interaction between language and vision. I will first talk a little bit about the human model and what the challenges of cross-modal interaction or cross-modal language comprehension really are. I then need to talk a little bit about weighted constraint dependency grammar. I apologize to everybody who knows already about this because I talk so many times about this. When I come to the core, that's namely predictive parsing on the one hand and applying this predictive parsing to parsing in the visual world paradigm. And finally, a look into the glass sphere to see what might be the next challenge. So the human model, if it comes to cross-modal language comprehension, establishes a bidirectional interaction. That's the first requirement. Language guides the visual attention. The visual attention helps to process speech and language. The human model exhibits a high degree of robustness. It's able to deal with cross-modal conflict. With what you listen to need not to be in the same as what you see in the world. It might have to deal with a problem of incomplete evidence. Not everything you hear about is seen in the visual environment and vice versa. Agreement. And you have to deal with uncertainty, so you are not quite sure what you see there, or you are not quite sure whether you understood right. You have to deal with structural and referential ambiguity. You have several objects with the same naming and which one the people are talking about. The human model takes timely decisions in a dynamic environment. The utterance unfolds over time. The utterance is not a static event, but it's something which develops. So you have to have incremental analysis. On the other hand, vision is an attention-driven thing in the human model. You do not process a picture, for instance, once, but you scan it incrementally and extracting more and more information from the picture as you go along. And by doing so, it might happen that you need to revise your intermediate interpretations, but later on it becomes obvious that this was not quite appropriate. The information fusion between the two channels is quite rapid. It's largely based on anticipation of upcoming stimuli. It's not the stimulus itself. It's what you expect what the next stimulus will be. And that makes it actually that such a rapid interaction. It's not reducing the time lag to zero. It's the attempt to get a negative time lag, to see into the future what comes next and base your actions on these predictions. And usually linguists or psycholinguists study this phenomenon in the visual world paradigm. You look at a picture while you're listening to a related utterance and your eye movements are monitored to study the time course of reference resolution as one of the most important tasks of language comprehension. Now we come to how can we attack attack this problem, and the means we applied have been weighted constraint dependency grammar. That was, we have been concerned with for years already. It's a very long-term activity, and weighted constraint dependency grammar was quite successful in solving a number of issues in the area of psycholinguistically inspired modeling of language processing. So weighted constraint dependency grammar models conditions on dependency edges or combinations of them. It assigns individual penalties to these constraints, and they indicate how severe a constraint violation is taken. We are searching for the optimal combination of edges, and there are a number of possibilities, and the most successful one has been the so-called frobbing by the author of the thing. It's a transformation-based approach. You start with initial structure. The better the guess, the better the result will be. You find the most severe constraint violation for this initial structure, and you try to repair it by choosing an alternative attachment point, by choosing a different edge label, or choosing a different morphosyntactic reading from the dictionary. And what is carried out there is a heuristic taboo search, so you have to expect non-optimal results doing so. It turned out that this approach was able to achieve a very high accuracy. It was for some time, so until 5 years ago approximately, the state of the art for German dependency parsing, if you only look at the accuracy. Since that time, we have lost the race and other approaches are more successful. I will come to this later on. So the reasons why it was so good at that time was it did preferential reasoning. Yeah, it's exactly what Walter von Hahn proposed for the humanities as well. It made use of a huge dictionary. If you expand it to inflectional forms, it's more than a million ones. And it's based on the integration of shallow predictive components. But I will come to in a minute. Accuracy is not the whole story for me. There are other important properties of a parsing algorithm which are not covered by its accuracy. First, I will shortly explain what a predictive component is, because this is important to understand how the interfacing with the visual knowledge could be established. We have components which are trained independently on corpus data. These predictors are usually unreliable. We are all familiar with it. And the predictions also might contradict each other because there are several ones. So we have an architecture. You have a sentence which comes into the parser, and out comes a dependency structure. That's the traditional thing. But then we have additional input channels available by means of constraints. We can use the constraints as accessing additional information from the environment. So we first took a part of speech tagger, and that turned out to be an enabling technology. Without the part of speech tagger, nothing could happen. But the nice thing here is that the predictions of a part of speech tagger are integrated in a weak manner, so the parser can override them. We continued with a chunk parser, we took a super tagger, we took a PP attacher, and we took a simple shift reduce parser for non-predictive, for projective structures, although the parser itself is meant to find non-projective ones. And all these components are unreliable to a certain degree, sometimes more, sometimes less, but still, we got a high degree of synergy. Nothing of these predictors was superfluous. They all contributed a little bit to the overall accuracy. And so we ended up with something like 94% of attachment score. And even if the components contradicted each other, that the part of speech tagger said the opposite as the super tagger did, for instance, so still they improved the overall performance. So the basic message is we have not only the traditional input channel where the sentence goes in, but we have additional means to feed in information in a sideway manner. So we can predefine part of a structure by evidence from other sources. And this predefinition is a weak one. So it can be accepted as a recommendation, but it need not be complied to. The other important things which are can be found with this approach is a strong anytime behavior. It's not only interruptible, you can interrupt it at any point in time, but it's also decisive. It gives you always the most promising interpretation at that particular point upon request. Of course, always at the price that this might be not the globally valid one, so you have to revise it and to reanalyze. Do some reanalysis. It's robust against a lot of different internal conflicts, so our grammar rules are not consistent. We have a lot of preferences which contradict each other. The utterance and its context may contradict. You have incomplete utterances, which usually are ungrammatical anyhow because they are incomplete, And the actual continuations you experience later on might contradict what you expected earlier. And additionally, it has a very high potential for error diagnosis, so the constraint violations detected by the parser can be used to indicate deviations from the norm. The list continues almost endlessly. We have used it to disambiguate not a single representational level like a surface syntax structure, but multiple related description layers in parallel. For instance, in such a German sentence, the daughter searches for the mother, which is the famous subject-object ambiguity in German, has a surface syntactic structure here with a fronted object, and it has some deeper semantic structure. You see it's inspired again by the Prague model. You have different description layers like the tactogrammatical level, for instance, and usually we depict these things as the arrows below the sentence. The coupling between these levels, the semantic one and the surface syntactic one, is again a mapping established by weighted constraints. So it's a weak coupling. The things need not to be coincide. And there are famous psycholinguistic examples where you can show that humans play with this vagueness, that they reanalyze the syntactic level, but don't also reanalyze the according semantic one. So we are left with an inconsistency between what we have perceived syntactically and what we have perceived semantically. And finally, we have been able to show that the approach can be made sensitive to extra-linguistic contextual influences actually by using the semantic layer as the interface to the environment. And because the constraints are truly relational, the interface between the description layers can be made bidirectional one. So now we have all the ingredients together. We can start cooking. Ingo Schröder provided the first prototype system and experimented with different solution strategies. Killian Ford introduced the hybrid parsing idea with very many components working together to solve the same task. He also wrote a broad coverage grammar, which was a really huge enterprise, and he was the one who had obtained the state-of-the-art accuracy for German. Patrick McCray took the parser and combined it with a cross-modal interface with visual input, which, however, was simulated, not real visual input, and he studied effects of underspecified and uncertain evidence. Niels Boyk pioneered the incremental predictive parsing and introduced virtual nodes to integrate the not yet seen words, to build them in the structure already, although they have not been seen so far. Arne Köhn made a multi-threaded implementation and was for the first time able to show that parsing can proceed in a push mode. In a push mode, not the parser says when it is ready to take the next word, but the external source says. Every second, a word is fed into the parser, and the parser has to keep pace. And if you increase the speech rate by feeding more words per time into the parser, the parser has to keep to deal with this speed. And Christopher Baumgartner finally was the one who combined this with a component for visual attention and fed this component with the linguistic predictions produced by the incremental predictive parser, and also investigated parsing in dynamically changing context. And I will talk now a little bit more about the first and the last item here, because that's the topic of my talk. Predictive parsing needs to be contrasted with naive incremental processing. Naive incremental processing attaches a word as soon as possible, as soon as it can attach it. That is sometimes called eager processing, but for us of other purposes, it's not eager enough. Because in such a case, the attachment is pending until the attachment point becomes available. And in a German subordinate clause, the verb comes last. So the very point when you can draw all the attachment edges, it's the very last word of a sentence. So that's too late. That's too late for doing any predictive analysis. And the result is always that you end up with a fragmented and therefore less informative interpretation. Predictive parsing collects all these things and attaches them to virtual nodes. And virtual nodes can be included in the structure as well. And that allows you to build a connected interpretation, and that is more informative than what naive incremental processing does. So if you have a German subordinate clause which starts with an initial conjunction, and this already raises the expectation that eventually a verb has to show up. And you are able to produce a complete dependency tree for this situation. If you don't have any virtual nodes, you can't. The initial conjunction is pending. Yeah? You have no attachment point available for it. And so it continues. Next comes a determiner, and the determiner immediately raises the expectation that a noun needs to follow it, to be attached to it. And if a noun finally arrives, it can be replaced for the virtual noun, the virtual node. And if the next determiner, funny thing is here, because the article carries the dative case marker, you can already decide that obviously it's introducing a dative object. Even at that very early point in time, you haven't seen the complete noun phrase at all at that point in time. If there is a second determiner, again, it raises the expectation that a noun is necessary to complete the structure, and that is finally substituted by the appearing noun. And finally, or eventually, the verb appears and the sentence is complete. And in all these intermediate steps, you can always create a partial semantic interpretation for the sentence, which is available very early in time. And it is based on predictions of what might come later on. The nice thing is that all this requires no specific procedural component, but everything is done by the general throbbing mechanism, this transformation-based approach. And the reanalysis behavior, if necessary, also results from this transformation-based approach, because the optimum is shifting if new evidence is fed into the parser. So now we take this approach and apply it to the visual world paradigm, and we would like, as psycholinguists do it with humans, we would like to test the predictive power in a similar setting. And therefore, we interface the parser with a bottom-up model of visual attention that has been developed by Itti and Koch already 15 years ago. And it outputs a saliency landscape. This is visual saliency, not linguistic saliency, a visual saliency landscape. And this visual saliency landscape is now modulated by top-down information from the parser. And because the parser is working incrementally, the visual saliency landscape changes over time. And we observe how it does it change. So the visual stimuli are a little bit awkward because they have been invented by psycholinguists. It's not my invention. You always have a picture with three characters. One is visually ambiguous. That's the center, the person in the center, here called a princess. And two are visually unambiguous. The person visually ambiguous is because it's doing something, in that case brushing, and it's something is done with it. It's splashed by the tourist. The tourist is unambiguous because it only splashes, but nobody is doing something with him. And the same thing is with the gangster. The gangster is passive and only brushed, but is not doing something itself. And the linguistic stimuli are all the sentences of a very simple type. The fairy, which is also linguistically ambiguous, brushes the gangster. And in German, these case markers are for the German, not for the translation. And you depict the saliency landscape on top of this picture. These are the yellow reddish blobs. Initially, that's the left picture, you see the saliency is almost equally distributed over the different graphical objects. And after processing the sentence, that's the right picture, all the saliency has been collected by the gangster because it's the last thing which has been mentioned in the sentence. Yeah, all the attention went there. And now we study how the attention changes over time. In the right diagram, you see the saliency of the visual agent, that is the person who splashes, and the visual patient, that is the person who is brushed. developing over time. And initially, you see the saliency is almost the same. Yeah? And later on, it starts to deviate, it starts to dissociate, but the attention is going to the visual patient, that's the person who is brushed, and the saliency for the person who splashes almost goes down to zero. And the interesting thing is that the time point when this dissociation appears is quite different. On the left point, you see it happens when the noun appears. That is, after the gangster is mentioned, the system detects, oh yeah, I should look to the gangster, as humans do. That's the funny thing. Yeah? And no, sorry, as humans do not, because humans do use predictions. That's the right picture. Now we switch on the prediction component, and you see it happens already when the verb is spoken, not when the gangster is spoken. So already by saying the verb brushing, the attention goes to the gangster because that person is brushed. Yeah? Here you see the effect of predictions, and that makes the integration of this knowledge as fast as it is. Here is the same thing for the ambiguous character. It's not so interesting. The only thing you can see is that on the left side, the curve is a little bit flatter than on the right side. This elevated curve is the influence of because it's not only mentioned, but it's also at the same time predicted as something which is expected. And the nice thing is that all these graphs almost perfectly replicate the findings of human subjects. Yeah? So there's a very high degree of psycholinguistic relevance. The same thing can be applied to dynamic environments as well. So this is a virtual world in which you can walk around and see things from different perspectives. And what's from this perspective right off is later on left off because you have moved around. And then you can investigate quite other things. For instance, when certain pieces of evidence appear sooner or later and how this affects the ongoing processing in the system. So now, what comes next? So WCDG has nice procedural properties. I mentioned all of them. It's anytime, it's robust, it's hybrid, it's multi-levelable, it's non-monotonic, it's diagnostic, but it has drawbacks. It's extremely slow. It requires labor-intensive manual grammar development. We estimated it for 5 person years for a highly skilled person, and it's no longer state-of-the-art in parsing quality. I mentioned this already. What's state-of-the-art in parsing quality right now? Two approaches, which is Turbo Parser, based on integer linear programming, and the RBG parser, which has the nice property that it separates the generation of the dependency trees from scoring them. And that's something we are highly interested in. And both of them are much more efficient than our WCDG parser, and they are more expressive because they can capture higher order constraints, which we cannot do for efficiency reasons. But on the other hand, they lack most of the properties we would like to see with it. Yeah? And the question is, can these approaches be modified to regain these properties? And we did a first step, that is predictive parsing with Turbo Parser, by simply providing an additional node, it's called unused, and three integer linear equations, which roughly say a virtual node cannot have any daughters, a virtual node, which is not used, a virtual node can only be the root node if it has daughters, and only virtual nodes may be attached to this special node unused. That's sufficient to run it in incremental mode. There are, however, some limitations. It's only pseudo-incremental parsing. We cannot really reuse the preceding results to obtain the next ones. So, and also, it has no full reanalysis capability. So there is still a lot of work to do. We are trying to investigate parsing into multi-level representations. Amr Rikabi will be talking about this today. We will try to study the predictive capabilities with more varied utterances and richer and more natural visual stimuli, not the strange characters in the picture over there. We will try to exploit the diagnostic capabilities for language learning purposes, where it's also a cross-modal task because the visual context can here be used to determine the intended interpretation of a student. And this is research carried out by Christine Köhn. She is going to talk about this today as well. And, no, you are not. Oh, sorry. You forgot what I said right now. Last item is we would like to experiment with active vision approaches because visual attention is not an ENDS. And by cycling this, it's used as an ENDS, not as a means. But we see it as a means to improve language comprehension. So what we would like to achieve is that's the red feedback loop in the visual component, that we feed back the saliency map into the visual processing to get more information from the visual channel, which might help to improve language processing. That's my ultimate goal, and I hope to do a little bit before I'm going to be pensioned the next day. Okay, so I will end with this. Thank you very much for your attention. I know, yeah. I mentioned before, yeah.
We have not thought in terms of prediction.
Yeah, right. That was only after the word is mentioned, saliency rises. Yeah. I remember your talk very, very vividly, yeah. And you know, that's the nice thing with scientific cooperation. You will never know what's the purpose it's good for. 20 years later, I came up with this project, yeah? 20 years later, and I'm quite sure I was inspired here.
I don't have 20 years to come back to your prediction.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. We will talk again about it, yeah.